Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us Sammamish poet Michael Dillon Welch, who has quite a bio that's filled with publications as well as advocacy for poetry. His poetry, essays, and book reviews have appeared in hundreds of journals and anthologies in at least 20 languages. He's been an advocate for poetry, especially haiku, for more than 25 years, organizing or helping to organize such events as Poets in the Park, Burning Word, Haiku North America, the Seebeck Haiku Getaway, and National Haiku Writing Month. He also curates readings for Soul Food Poetry Night, which just celebrated its 10th anniversary, and the Redmond Association of Spoken Word. His haiku have been recited to the Empress of Japan, presented at the Baseball Hall of Fame, printed on balloons, and etched in stone in New Zealand. In 2012, a Japanese translation from one of his books was printed on the back of 150 million U.S. postage stamps. In 2013, he was the keynote speaker for the Haiku International Association's annual convention in Tokyo. His recent books include Becoming a Haiku Poet, Fire in the Treetops, Celebrating 25 Years of Haiku North America, The RASP, which is the Redmond Association's poetry anthology, Here, There, and Everywhere, and the art book True Colors. Forthcoming this year from Neoposis Press is Seven Suns, Seven Moons, a collaboration with Tanya McDonald. Michael lives in Sammamish, Washington, with his wife and two children, and his websites are nahairimo.com, which I will spell, nahairimo.com, and www.graceguts.com. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to join you.
After reading your bio once again, I am thrilled to be able to get talk to you about your activities. And I guess my very first question for you is going to be, how did haiku come into your life, and what made you stick with it and draw so many connections to other poets and geographies and publications and opportunities to publish them in unusual places?
It began, I think, because my middle name is Dylan. I was named after Dylan Thomas, which gave me a sense of poetry that my siblings didn't have. I always wrote short poetry when I was a kid. And when I discovered haiku in high school, when it was taught in an early English class, I immediately gravitated towards it and have been writing haiku ever since. I wrote it very badly for at least 10 years and then slowly began to read translations and books about haiku. And then about 12 years after I started, I encountered Cor Vandenhoevel's The Haiku Anthology, which radically changed my perception of haiku from the popular misunderstandings to a more literary sense. And as a result of that, I started getting connected with various haiku organizations, and that has led me to a connection with haiku poets around the world. It's a wonderful community.
Yes. And do you study Japanese as well, the language?
My wife is Japanese, but unfortunately, not much of the language has rubbed off on me as a result. She says that haiku is something that old people do, many retirees and so on, and that's true in Japan and perhaps somewhat true in North America as well. But I have studied a little bit of the language. I have worked with a co-translator, Emiko Miyashita, and we have done numerous books together.
Well, you are unusual then that you adopted it as a favorite form when you were in school, not old. Maybe you're an old soul, though. But it does occur to me that the kind of thinking you have to do in haiku, which you could probably elaborate on, is one of those things that keeps the brain sharp and keeps the observational powers sharp. So it makes sense to me that older people might be benefiting from writing haiku. What do you think?
I think that makes sense. Maybe it's like doing Sudoku every morning or taking a walk. It exercises you in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for you no matter what your age. Perhaps keeps you sharp if you're getting older.
Yeah, or you have time when you're getting older to think in the way that a poet thinks. I know that haiku is always introduced in early grade how to write poetry curriculums, and so maybe there'll be a reversal about what age group this appeals to. Do you have some haiku that you might read to us?
Yes, I've made a selection of some haiku about hands, which a friend noted that I write a lot about. So here are some hand haiku. I'll read maybe a dozen. Mountain spring, in my cupped hand, pine needles. Birthday picnic, grandma's throw, halfway to the toddler. We walk the boardwalk hand in hand, sharing ice cream headaches. Beached kelp. We examine each other's lifelines. You squeeze my hand. How still the sky after fireworks. Summer moonlight. The potter's wheel slows. And in a case like that one, I hope the hands are implied, mm-hmm. The potter's hands. Clicking off the late movie, the couch cushion reinflates. Gathering clouds, the feel of the Gettysburg Address etched in bronze. Accumulating snow, oven mitts praying on the counter. Toll booth lit for Christmas. From my hand to hers, warm change. Christmas Eve. Bits of a price sticker stuck to my finger. And one more. Dense fog. I write your name on the airport window.
Michael, I could listen to these forever. There, I love how they go from the extraordinary observations of nature or a moment in time to something like eating ice cream and getting an ice cream headache or the cushions on the couch reinflating. It's a wonderful technique for drawing everything into poetry. I mean, people think that poetry has to be something other than the everyday, but I think that poetry makes the everyday something other than the everyday.
One of my favorite quotations is from Roland Barthes, who said, "Haiku has this phantasmagorical property that we always suppose we can write such things easily," which I take to mean that they can be difficult. But the point is, you want to make them look really easy and ordinary and everyday. Kerouac said, "Haiku should be as simple as porridge." And I just take that to mean that it should be accessible and not feel distant or esoteric. It can get old pretty quickly if haiku by Westerners are about Japanese subjects. So I think it's better to write about your life and things that matter to you and that are ordinary in your life wherever you live.
So this is probably a good time to remind us what the parameters of writing in haiku are and whether we have to follow those exactly, whether you do, and how that works.
I like to think of haiku as having targets. And in writing a haiku, you hit certain targets but may not hit all of them all the time. And you may choose to miss one or accidentally miss one, and it can still be a good haiku. So some of those targets are to do with form, content, style, tone, and so on. Most of us have been taught haiku as a 5-7-5 syllable counting exercise. And that's really a misunderstanding of what goes on in haiku, because in Japan, they don't count syllables, they count sounds. And to illustrate that point, the word haiku itself is two syllables in English, but counts as three sounds in Japanese, ha-i-ku, even though they don't say it that way. That's how they count it. And other words just are counted differently. The word scarf, one syllable in English, counts as four sounds in Japanese. So if you're writing 5-7-5 syllables in English, you're actually writing a significantly longer poem than what the Japanese write. And 5-7-5 is really a violation of the Japanese form rather than a preservation of it. As an alternative, I use organic form, and often in three lines, although even that is a Western convention, and try to capture a moment in a brief way. One breath is one way of defining it. Linguists say that usually about 10 to 14 syllables in English is equivalent to the 17 sounds in Japanese. But it's really other things that guide me rather than the form. And when I encountered Cor Vanden Heuvel's book, The Haiku Anthology, what changed my perception of haiku was that the vast bulk of the poems were not 5-7-5. And so in understanding why, I shifted my understanding from form to content. I began to think about what I was saying and how I was saying it, and not merely counting syllables, which is what too many people do. So instead, the other things I aim for, these are targets that I try to aim for often, but not always, is to have what's called a kigo, or a season word, something that suggests the season. For example, here's another hand haiku. Spring breeze, the pull of her hand as we near the pet store. So spring, I'm directly naming the season, but often it could be something a little more subtle that suggests the season. And here's a quick aside for you. I have written a parody of that poem. A certain substance has been made legal in Washington State a few years ago. Spring breeze, the pull of her hand as we near the pot store.
Well, I don't know if it's a parody. It might stand on its own. Huh?
It might. The other thing I also aim for in haiku is what's called a kirigi, or a cutting word. And this is, in Japanese, it's a spoken word that divides the poem into two parts. It's sort of like a spoken punctuation that's used only in haiku in Japanese. And in English, the equivalent is to give the poem two parts. So spring breeze, one part, the context in this case. The pull of her hand as we near the pet store, that's another thing that juxtaposes with the first part. And the idea with the juxtaposition is to create a space, or ma is the Japanese term, for something that's going on between the two parts, something that connects them. And in this case, spring breeze has a sort of youthful joyfulness to it. The pull of her hand as we near the pet store, you can think of a kid eager to see pets, and there's a youthfulness in that as well. So there's an interplay between the two parts that Harold Henderson called internal comparison.
So all of this is going on as you have a sort of, do you feel a haiku moment and then remember the targets when you're writing?
Yes, there are other targets. Another key one for me is write about your five senses and to write about them in an objective way. Keep subjectivity out of the poem. So you don't judge what you say, you just present what you experience. And that way, the reader can have the same experience. And in the workshops I give, the key thing I tell people to underline, if nothing else, is this. Don't write about your feelings. Write about what caused your feelings.
Right.
That makes all the difference.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend. In case you've just joined us, you're listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila is talking with Michael Dillon Welch about his career writing poetry, publishing anthologies of poems, and translating poetry from Japanese.
This is exciting, exciting stuff. I know that the poet Allen Ginsberg had something called American Sentences, which was his way of talking about how the idea of haiku might be approached in U.S. English. So I'm wondering what you do with the American sentence.
I explore that too. I've written hundreds of them. They're fun to write. I've used them for my own purposes. I've used them to record things that my kids have said. I could read you a few examples.
Well, maybe, but can you give us a little definition first? Because I'm not sure I actually gave a definition, just that I know he...
Yeah, Ginsberg, I think, wanted to make the haiku more Americanized, and his choices for the form were simply to count syllables, 17, and he thought of the form as a one-line form, which matches the way haiku in Japanese is a one-line vertical form. He wanted to capture a moment, but what he ignored was the seasonal reference and the juxtaposition, and he also tended to ignore the objectivity. So it's basically one-line poem that captures a personal moment.
So is that how you use it?
Somewhat. When I've used it to capture things my kids have said when they were younger, it's bits of conversation, it's just experience or description of things that are going on, and I see them as very different from haiku, and at least in the way I use it, hopefully a little more amusing than the haiku, which tends to be a little more serious.
Do you have some examples handy of American sentences?
Yes. This is in quotation marks from my daughter. We're going to Japan, Daddy, but don't worry, they have a toilet. Or Not just Triceratops, Daddy. I like all the dinosaurs, like you.
I hope you have a couple more to read to us.
Yes, this is from my son. Daddy, if that team is taking the field, where will they be taking it? Or here's another from my daughter. Hey, Daddy, look what I got for my birthday. It's an armadillo.
So you're not counting syllables when you do these?
Well, I am. These are counted as 17 syllables. That's how Ginsberg defined his, his take on this.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that, because although it might not be useful in a haiku to keep it in its tradition, it might be a tweaking of that tradition that works against a good haiku. And in American sentences, maybe it really does keep us, if we write to 17 syllables, keep us having to be crisp.
Except I think there's a greater discipline in haiku in that you're not just being crisp, you're being crisper than 17 syllables. And by focusing on the other targets, those are actually a much harder discipline. And a lot of people will pass off their 17-syllable 575 things and think they've written a haiku, and they've greatly missed the mark because they've missed all the other targets. And they may not even be aware of the other targets.
Right. So when you experience a haiku written by somebody else and it falls flat as a haiku in your terms, how do you experience that as a reader or listener? How can you tell the difference?
I have an essay about this subject coming out in Modern Haiku next year. It's called Haiku Stances, and it identifies different approaches to haiku. For example, it could be educational, where somebody is teaching haiku in order to teach kids about syllables or to teach them about Japanese culture. Or it could be meditational, where somebody is just writing as a form of awareness practice. Or it could be diaristic, where you're just recording things that happen to you like a diary entry. And I've seen all these examples in poems. It could be recreational, where a person is just trying to have fun. And that's where the majority of what you see on the internet is, I think. People just counting their syllables and having fun.
Yeah.
But you could also have fun without counting syllables. So recreational can take various forms. And then there's also a literary approach, which tries to balance all the other targets and bring in the Japanese tradition and pay closer attention to form, which means not necessarily 575, and paying attention to the other targets. I would be careful, at least this is my approach to it, is that I don't consider 575 traditional, at least in English. That's a misunderstanding, I believe. So to refer to 575 as traditional isn't accurate. It's traditional in Japanese, but even in Japanese, the masters deviated from the 575 occasionally, and there are whole schools of haiku in Japan that pay no attention to the form, go, shichi, go, it's called in Japanese, and they'll be very free form. So there's a lot of variety in Japan. And although 575 is traditional in Japan, it doesn't refer to syllables. It refers to what's called on.
Sound.
Which means sound, yeah.
Yes, thank you. Before we leave haiku, I just want to remind people that you said early on in our talk how wonderful having haiku community is, in your case, worldwide. I know that there are many haiku societies and groups of people writing in that form who get together. And I think that I just want to make the point that that's an outgrowth of people working in haiku. That's really wonderful, a way of sharing observation and feeling.
Yes, that's one of the best rewards I've gotten from haiku, is that community. There has been a haiku group in Port Townsend, although I think it's a little dormant right now, but there is the Haiku Northwest group in Seattle, the Bellingham Haiku group in Bellingham. There's another group in Vashon Island, another in Tacoma. And there are groups in Portland, Vancouver, Vancouver Island, and other places on the West Coast, and then the National Haiku Society of America and Haiku Canada organizations.
Wow.
Plus many more in other countries.
So a lot to research on the internet or in your own community in the hopes of finding some fellow haiku writers and share that interest. So I do know, too, that you are a skillful poet in longer forms. That must be kind of interesting to work so naturally in shorter forms and then work in longer forms. I'm going to have a hunch that all that practice with haiku has in some way influenced the longer pieces. Am I right?
I think so. I think it tends to make me think of tightening the longer pieces. I don't think that's anything special thanks to haiku, but it can't have hurt. I know any poet of any length tries to condense and tighten and use words carefully.
Some people are better at it than others and more trusting. I should say more trusting of it, more trusting that compression works and helps, even if the poem is lengthy. So do you happen to have handy one of your longer poems to read to us?
Yes. This is a poem that connects to haiku. It's called Flowers on the Roof of Hell, and it begins with a haiku by Isa, one of the four great Japanese masters. He lived in the 1700s into the 1800s in Japan. And so the first bit is the quote from Isa, and then I tell a short story about this. Flowers on the Roof of Hell. In this world, we walk on the roof of hell, gazing at flowers. Today, Isa came over for dinner. Nothing fancy, just Thai takeout from the place down the road. He came on foot, carrying a satchel. I welcomed him at the door, and he removed his sandals. The low evening sun sparkled through the tall glass of water I gave him. He admired it before he drank it in one go. I showed him to the living room, where he sat on the couch almost delicately. Then, as if conscious of his bare feet, he curled them up under himself. We talked of poetry all through dinner, stray noodles landing on the plain wooden table as we ate. We talked of favorite poets and poems and the challenge of writing freshly about old subjects. We talked of writing one's joy in a fiercely crushed world of flowers on the roof of hell. When he told me it was time for him to go, I asked if I could give him a ride, but he declined as I knew he would. He had a long way to travel, but held a finger to his lips and gently shook his smile. Then Isa took his sandals in hand and padded off into the dark. I opened the satchel he left behind. Inside it bloomed white asters.
Thank you, Michael. I would say that your study of haiku and your immersion in it does have an influence on your poetry going from this one. What a wonderful story, both what he did in haiku and what you do with his visitation. Do you remember how that poem came to you?
Yeah, I was given a challenge by David Lanoux, who runs a website where he's seeking to translate all 20,000 of Isa's haiku. He's about halfway through. It's a huge undertaking. And he had a challenge inviting people to write a longer poem about Isa. This one tumbled out.
It's great. Thank you for reading it to us. The image of the roof of hell, here we are.
Yes.
Astounding. That will keep me thinking for a long time.
Where that comes from is Isa led a very troubled life. His mother died. He was kicked out of the house. His house burned down. All of his children died, one after another. His stepmother was wicked and mean to him, and lots of problems in his life. And his life was walking on the roof of hell. However, he found solace in haiku and in insects and in children and in writing joyfully despite this hell he was often living through.
Well, you've said it well in that image and phrase. So we don't have too much longer to talk. I wish we could talk for longer, and maybe we will in a future program. Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about your two websites and how people might access them and enjoy them and learn from them.
My main website is graceguts.com, and that is named after an E. Cummings poem, and there's a Why Graceguts link on the site that refers to the reasons for that. Basically, he says, let's make it serious, something authentic and delirious, something genuine like a mark in a toilet, graced with guts and gutted with grace. So that's where it comes from. And it's basically a website that covers my poetic musings. So I have sections on essays, page listing books I've published, collaborations with other poets, information about editing I've done. I've done a couple hundred trade books on various subjects. There's a section on a haiku computer game I did, introductions I've written for various books by other people, photographs, poems, haiku and senyu, linked poetry, lots of other things. It's an ongoing labor of love.
That's why I call you such an advocate for poetry and poets. That is quite a labor to put all that together. And I hope people will go to Grace Gutts, which is GRACEGUTS.com. Okay, and now you can continue.
Yes, the other site is NahiRaimo.com, which is short for National Haiku Writing Month. In 2010, I did the NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month. And late October of 2010, just before that started in November, I thought, well, there ought to be a National Haiku Writing Month. And NahiRaimo would be an obvious takeoff on NaNoWriMo. And I thought, well, how about February, the shortest month for the shortest genre of poetry? And so I set up a website for that, NahiRaimo.com, and set up a Facebook page, and it immediately became very active. And on the very first day on the Facebook page, when I was trying to promote this, somebody said, we need a writing prompt. And so I provided a prompt, and every day there's been a writing prompt through the month of February. And that first year, that would have been February of 2011, that first year when the month ended, people said, oh, let's keep doing this. Let's do it year-round. And so on the Facebook page, I have a guest prompter who provides a daily writing prompt every day, year-round, although the official month is still February.
When you said the official month is February, I just want to tell our listeners that this would be a very important site to go to. And I am curious about, so on a leap year, it would be 29 haiku, and on a regular year, it would be 28, and people are to write one every day?
Yes, the idea of NahiRaimo is to write one haiku a day during the month. So on leap years, there'd be 29 poems to write. So it's slightly harder on leap years. The value of it is that it gets you writing haiku daily and thinking in a haiku mind, which is different from writing 28 or 29 poems all in one day.
Right.
It's that habit that I'm trying to encourage.
As we sum up, too, I want to say that is that brings together your advocacy for poetry, your enjoyment of a community of poets, which you've obviously created. People can contact each other through Facebook. I'm in awe of your career and what you do and your way of explaining the poetic forms you're using and your poetry. So I hope to talk to you again for our program. And for today, I'm very reluctant to say goodbye, Michael. It's been a really wonderful conversation.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, www.writingitreal.com/audio. In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.